records and have them in your collection. Thank you for listening today. Thank you for supporting this radio station. And please continue to dial us at 212-209-2950. The African American History Pack is a $250 donation. If you want the deluxe package, that includes 9 DVDs and a book, When Rocks Cry Out. We're grateful to you. Thank you to author Horace Butler and to all of you for listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. My name is Tony Bates. Until next time I see you, please keep questioning everything.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Programming note, Women Fight Back will be back on the air Fridays at 5 p.m. next week. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News. Hopefully everything is unmuted and ready to do this program here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned. It's 1 minute past 6 p.m.
Good evening. The war in Yemen grinds on even as the United States sells more missiles to Saudi Arabia, the chief protagonist in the war. Now the worst human rights crisis on earth. Anemic job growth signals COVID's effect is still holding back the economy, and more cases of Omicron turn up in New York as the parents of a school shooter, an accused school shooter, are on the run, seemingly on the run. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, December 3rd, 2021. More than 60 organizations urged the United Nations General Assembly yesterday to establish an investigative body to gather and preserve evidence of serious human rights violations during Yemen's 7-year conflict, including possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. The organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, say the matter is urgent, particularly after the UN Human Rights Council voted in October to shut down its investigation into atrocities in Yemen. The group of eminent experts had reported that potential war crimes have been committed by all sides. The Geneva-based Council's vote was a stinging defeat for Western nations and a victory for Russia, China, Bahrain, and other countries. Meanwhile, the United States Special Envoy for Yemen, Timothy Lenderking, urged for less pessimism towards a ceasefire and peaceful resolution to the Yemen war during the Rome Mediterranean dialogue held today.
For anybody who I think felt that there was going to be an easy solution or a quick win in Yemen, I think was not viewing the situation realistically. I do believe, however, that with the decision of a handful of people, there could be a ceasefire in Yemen, and there could be more traction on the humanitarian situation, because I think as the donors feel some reluctance to continue to fund humanitarian and development operations in Yemen when there isn't a discernible political track that has yet emerged. I do think there are a number of things in our favor. As the foreign minister pointed out, there is a willingness on the part of the Saudis. They declared a ceasefire, their openness to a ceasefire back in March. I think the Yemen government is keen to support that. This is an important, you know, centerpiece of the whole effort. But I urge you not to be quite so pessimistic and others. I think that in 2022, we're going to see better progress as these issues get defined more clearly, as the UN envoy comes on board, and as U.S. efforts continue in support of a peaceful resolution.
And that's U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Timothy Linder King. Yemeni Foreign Minister Ahmad Awad bin Mubarak attended the annual conference on geopolitical issues to discuss the situation in his country, suffering civil war since 2014.
Really difficult, the situation. It's really now we are there is hope. There is a new envoy. He is now exploring the all the possibilities to resume the political talks. He was in Aden. He came. I met him there. He visited Taiz for the first time. He went to the West Coast, but yet not with the Houthis in Sana'a because they didn't receive him yet. So we will cooperate with him. We have, you know, our position as Yemeni government that there is no military solution for this conflict. At the end, we as Yemenis, we have to sit on the table and we have to resolve our problem. We are ready to do that. After all what Houthis did, we said they are most welcome to join the table. They have to respect just one constitutional principle, which is that all Yemenis are equal. No one has any, no one is superior or have divine right to rule the rest of the Yemen.
And as Yemeni Foreign Minister Ahmad Awad bin Mubarak, the conflict in Yemen between the Saudi-backed government, local factions backed by the UAE and Houthi Ansar Allah movement allied with Iran, along with the intervention of other international parties, led to what the United Nations has described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Danica Katovich is the Middle East and Peace Collective Coordinator for Code Pink. She says, don't hold your breath, that the United States and Saudi Arabia are really interested in ending the conflict.
About a month ago, the State Department announced up to $650 million sale of advanced medium range air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia. And they announced that the principal manufacturer would be Raytheon. The Biden administration would like to keep saying that all of the weapons, all the support that the U.S. continues to give to Saudi Arabia is defensive. But even when the U.S. got involved in the war in 2015, it was described as defensive. But all of these weapons can be and are being used against civilian populations in Yemen for the past 3 weeks or so. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been constantly bombing the city of Sana'a in Yemen. More recently, over the last few days, the airport in Sana'a has been bombed, and currently the airport is only being used by the UN.
Possibility of a ceasefire, is that a real talk?
I don't think the U.S. could be a part of a ceasefire agreement, considering that they continue to support Saudi Arabia. There's no way we could be an honest broker of peace there. As long as Saudi Arabia continues to use the blockade of millions of people in Yemen as a bargaining chip, then there's no ceasefire agreement coming anytime soon.
This talk of a ceasefire agreement is not real, is what you're saying.
I think it's far-fetched. There's a lot that has to be done, and the Houthis in Yemen have said over and over again that the blockade cannot be used as a bargaining chip in the ceasefire agreements. And today, the land, air, and sea blockade is still in place.
I just spoke with Doctors Without Borders the other day in Yemen, and they said it was a terrible circumstance, what they're seeing there every day.
Oh, absolutely. I believe the new statistic is every 75 seconds, a child is dying of starvation in Yemen because of the blockade. And it's not just food that Saudi Arabia is keeping out of Yemen, it's fuel. And the fuel blockade makes it so when food that they're allowing in comes into the ports, trucks cannot get the food to anywhere else in Yemen. So the starvation is very widespread because of the fuel blockade.
Where's the international outrage in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to think so. I mean, people have been hearing about this issue for so long, and they hear the statistics of every 75 seconds a child dies, but they don't really comprehend that it's real people. There is a joint resolution of disapproval in the Senate right now. So if you're in the U.S., you should be calling your senators, asking them to co-sponsor the joint resolution of disapproval to block this most recent arms sale to Saudi Arabia. And that's what people can be doing right now.
What's in it for the U.S. to allow this war to go on? We could stop it.
Yeah, we could stop it. Saudi Arabia has been, I wouldn't say a loyal ally, considering the Jamal Khashoggi killing, but the U.S. has vested interest in the proxy war with Iran and keeping a ally in the region, as well as oil interests as well.
So how long could this war continue on for?
Saudi Arabia is definitely losing the war, but as long as the U.S. continues to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, do diplomatic cover for Saudi Arabia, and provide any sort of aid in the war, then it could go on for as long as Saudi Arabia continues the blockade.
Danica Katovich is the Middle East and Peace Collective Coordinator for Code Pink. Kathy Kelly is a veteran peace activist.
This is a scandal. The United States has certainly eroded and, I believe, usurped any authority it could possibly have with regard to human rights or disarmament by continuing to arm the Saudis, by continuing to allow for a blockade, which is, it's imposing collective punishment on people who've already suffered so much. I mean, 100,000 Yemenis at least have been killed. And this is while multiple U.S. administrations have continued to arm Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has bullied and bribed other countries to go along with its actions and undermined anything that the United Nations might have done to try to put an end to this. So for the United States to continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia is, in a sense, saying to the entire world that any kind of rule of law with regard to Yemen is to be neglected.
Yeah, I actually had an opportunity a few days back to talk to the head of the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Yemen, and he was describing to me just horrendous circumstances in that hospital.
We've seen this before. I certainly recall going to hospitals in Iraq while Iraq was under economic sanctions, and to see mothers holding their children as those children are experiencing tortuous death is a cruelty which is almost beyond imagining. It's child sacrifice in our time. And why has this gone on for 7 years?
Why the U.S. is not doing whatever it can to end this conflict. Instead, it seems to be inflaming it.
There are major weapon companies that have strong relationships, very profitable relationships with Saudi Arabia, and exercise tremendous pull on Capitol Hill within the United States. We are a country whose top crop is weapons. And so the weapon makers almost always get the upper hand, and the Saudis want the United States weapons. So I think that has a great deal to do with it. And I also think that the Security Council being able to manipulate within the United Nations determinations about what resolutions will get passed has been disastrous for people in Yemen, because the resolutions have not even named Saudi Arabia as one of the warring parties.
Is this a proxy war that's developing between the United States, Israel, and Iran through these two other countries?
I'm not so sure that it would be right to call it a proxy war. I think this is a bludgeoning of another country because a richer country wants to steal their resources. Yemen shouldn't be such a poor country. They've got resources. But I believe Saudi Arabia wants to take those resources and has assured itself and its people that the time is somehow still on their side. And if they just hang in there longer, they can have access to the fisheries, to the farmlands, to the minerals that are under the ground, to the very valuable ports. And so this blockade has been established. And Yemen remarkably has not yet succumbed to a blockade that most other people all around the world would simply not be able to bear. And so I think it's a cruel and a vicious act that's being perpetrated on people who mean certainly no harm to the United States and cause us no security harms whatsoever.
Kathy Kelly is a veteran peace activist. Yemen has been convulsed by civil war since 2014, when Iran-backed Houthi rebels took control of the capital, Sana'a, and much of the northern part of the country. That forced the internationally recognized government to flee to the south, then to Saudi Arabia. A Saudi-led coalition entered the war in March 2015, backed by the United States, to try and restore President Abdelrabo Mansour Hadi to power. Despite a relentless air campaign and ground fighting, the war has deteriorated largely into a stalemate, and has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In another sign, the office of Vice President Kamala Harris has been embroiled in alleged dysfunction and controversy. Her senior advisor and chief spokesperson, Simone Sanders, is leaving her position at the end of the year. Sanders previously served as a senior advisor for Joe Biden's presidential campaign, and before that, she was press spokesperson for Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders' departure is the second from the vice president's office. Harris's communications chief, Ashley Etienne, a veteran of the Obama administration, announced she would leave last month. The Washington Post reports that Peter Vels, director of press operations, and Vince Evans, deputy director of the Office of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs in the vice president's office, are both expected to take new jobs close to the administration. Harris, the nation's first female vice president and the first person of Black and Asian descent to hold the post, has faced criticism that she hasn't done enough to address the issues in her portfolio, including addressing attacks on voting rights and tackling the root causes of immigration. In more Washington news, Senator Bernie Sanders is asking the White House to cut back a big Medicare premium hike set to take effect in weeks and tied to pricey Alzheimer's drugs, whose benefits have been widely questioned. In a letter Friday to President Joe Biden, the Vermont Independent called on the president to act immediately to prevent the apportion of an outrageous increase in Medicare premiums that's attributed to Aduhelm, a newly approved Alzheimer's medicine from drug maker Biogen, priced at $56,000 a year. If Biden agreed and found a way to do it, a planned January increase of $21.60 a month to Medicare's Part B premium for outpatient care would be slashed closer to $10. The monthly premium for 2022 would drop from $170.10 to about $159. And President Joe Biden today signed into law the stopgap spending bill that will keep the federal government running through February 18th after congressional leaders defuse a partisan standoff over federal vaccine mandates. The White House released a statement noting the bill signing and thanking congressional leaders for their work. The stopgap comes as an anemic jobs report shows the coronavirus is still bedeviling the economy despite 60% of Americans being vaccinated. The report, which is usually the most anticipated economic data by Wall Street each month, showed employers added only 210,000 jobs. It was a disappointing result when economists were expecting a much stronger hiring of about 530,000. And it raises worries the economy may stagnate while inflation remains high, something called stagflation from those who remember the 1970s. But the president said today things are still better than last year.
Our economy is markedly stronger than it was a year ago. And today, the incredible news that our unemployment rate has fallen to 4.2%. At this point in the year, we're looking at the sharpest one-year decline in unemployment ever. Simply put, America's back to work. And our jobs recovery is going very strong. Today's historic drop in unemployment rate includes dramatic improvements for workers who have often seen higher wages and higher levels of unemployment. Higher levels of unemployment. They are receiving higher wages. And the rate of Black and Hispanic unemployment is also dropping sharply. But that's not just jobs that are up. Wages are up, especially for hardworking Americans, often ignored in the past.
The president also explained his scratchy voice. He blames his grandson.
I'm okay. I have a test every day to see a COVID test. I have it checking for all the strains. What I have is a 1.5-year-old grandson who had a cold who likes to kiss his pop. And he'd been kissing in my anyway. But it's just a cold.
And in related news, a week of volatile swings on Wall Street ended today with more losses for stocks as a mixed batch of U.S. job market data triggered another bout of dizzying trading. The S&P 500 closed almost 1% lower after erasing a nearly percent gain in the early goings. The benchmark index was coming off a jolting stretch where it swerved by at least 1.2% in five straight days, pounded by uncertainty about how badly the newest coronavirus variant will hit the economy and about when the Federal Reserve will halt its immense support for financial markets. And a prosecutor filed involuntary manslaughter charges today against the parents of a teen accused of killing four students at a Michigan high school, saying they failed to intervene on the day of the tragedy despite being confronted with a drawing and chilling message, blood everywhere, that was found at the boy's desk. But the couple was nowhere to be found by law enforcement by mid-afternoon today. Authorities said they're still searching for them. Sheriff Mike Bouchard said their attorney had agreed to arrange the arrest if charges were filed, but he hasn't been able to reach them. Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald said James and Jennifer Crumbly committed egregious acts that facilitated the shootings.
The note contained the following: a drawing of a semi-automatic handgun pointing at the words, quote, "the thoughts won't stop, help me," end quote. In another section of the note was a drawing of a bullet with the following words above that bullet, quote, "blood everywhere," end quote. Between the drawing of the gun and the bullet is a drawing of a person who appears to have been shot twice and bleeding. Below that figure is a drawing of a laughing emoji. Further down the drawing are the words, quote, "my life is useless," end quote. And to the right of that are the words, quote, "the world is dead," end quote. As a result, James and Jennifer Crumbly were immediately summoned to the school. James and Jennifer Crumbly resisted the idea of them leaving the school at that time, of their son leaving the school at that time. Instead, James and Jennifer Crumbly left the high school without their son. He was returned to the classroom. When the news of the active shooter at Oxford High School had been made public, Jennifer Crumbly texted to her son at 1:22 p.m., quote, "Ethan, don't do it," end quote. At 1:37 p.m., James Crumbly called 911, reporting that a gun was missing from his house and he believed his son may be the shooter. Further investigation revealed that the 6-hour 9mm handgun purchased by James Crumbly was stored unlocked in a drawer in James and Jennifer's bedroom. Based upon the foregoing, the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office requested and received authorized, we charged 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter as to James Crumbly and 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter as to Jennifer Crumbly.
Parents in the United States are rarely charged in school shootings involving their children, even as most minors get guns from a parent or relative's house. And one of the most popular megachurch pastors in the United States is Joel Osteen, whose Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, can seat nearly 17,000 worshipers. He's not particularly political, but preaches what's often described as prosperity gospel, that God will smile on good Christians with a bounty of cash. The bounty was overflowing on November 10th when a plumber doing repairs in the church made a lucrative finding.
There was a loose toilet in the wall, and we removed the tile. Well, they removed the tile. Went to go remove the toilet, and I moved some insulation away, and about 500 envelopes fell out of the wall. I went ahead and contacted the maintenance supervisor that was there, and I went ahead and turned it all in.
Meanwhile, the Houston Police Department is still investigating a 7-year-old case involving the disappearance of $600,000 from Osteen's church. Maybe they found the money behind the toilet. Maybe. And Governor Kathy Hochul and Mayor Bill de Blasio announced last night at a rare joint news conference that there are Omicron variant viruses cases in the New York region. The leaders encouraged residents to get vaccinated to protect themselves from the coronavirus and urged them not to panic. They said it was too soon to know how much of a threat the variant might pose to the state.
We still don't have specific information on how the vaccines are holding up or the boosters are holding up to this variant, but it is real. We said it would be coming here shortly. While this may be highly transmissible, at least from the early evidence, and again, more information is still forthcoming, we want people to know that the early cases that have arisen are not life-threatening. They seem to be minor cases, and that is a source of good news for us right now. But in terms of the information we received, literally there are five cases identified today in the state of New York. No cause for alarm. We just want to make sure that the public is aware of information when we receive it. We don't have more information at this time, but we suspect there'll be more cases emerging. And the best thing that everyone can do is realize we're not defenseless against this variant at all. That vaccine we know is going to ensure that there's less severe symptoms. The booster is something I would highly recommend if you're
moved. And that is Governor Hochul. Even before the Omicron variant arrived, coronavirus cases had been rising in New York City. Daily case counts have increased more than 75% since November 1st. While 77% of New York City residents have received at least one shot of the vaccine, fewer than 20% of adults have gotten their booster shot. And finally, Columbia University held a vigil today for David Gurry, a graduate student killed in a random stabbing spree last night. The suspect is a 25-year-old and suspected gang member. Police don't think the victims knew each other. The attacks came 2 years after 18-year-old student Tessa Majors of Barnard was stabbed to death in a robbery in the same area. And that's some of the news for Friday, December 3rd, 2021. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
Local Station Board is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, December 8th at 7 p.m. This December will be the first meeting of the new Local Station Board. We will be seating and welcoming a slate of recently elected LSB members. Come meet the new members. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, December 8th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The meeting, accessible to the public, includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. 929-205-6099 and enter this meeting ID. 922-457-2995. And if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency 99.5. So it's 995-995. There is a benefit on December 3rd and 9th at the Christian Tierney Gallery in support of Revolution Books at 219 Bowery on the second floor, featuring revolutionary artist Dred Scott's 2019 Slave Rebellion reenactment of the 1811 Slave Revolt in New Orleans, Louisiana.
I wanted to reenact this and bring a vision of freedom and emancipation. Of, you know, the Slave Rebellion reenactment was a project that brought hundreds of black people, about 300 to 350 black people, with machetes and muskets and sickles and sabers, marching to the outskirts of New Orleans and in the city itself, chanting, "On to New Orleans, freedom or death, we're going to end slavery, join us."
For more information, go to ChristianTierney.com or call Revolution Books at 212-691-3345. That's a benefit private gallery tour with revolutionary artist Dred Scott.
Hello. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, host of Exploration, which reports on the impact of science on society, which is usually heard every Wednesday evening. First of all, Exploration is moving.